Hey, everybody. Thanks for taking the time to listen to this podcast from Forest City North Church. We're a church in London, Ontario. And our hope is that this message that you're listening to will have an impact on your life. I encourage you to grab a coffee, make yourself a tea, sit back, and enjoy this message. April 14th, 1970. April 14th, 1970. Three guys put on space suits, climbed into a spaceship, and were shot into space on a trip to the moon. Some of you remember this, don't you? Some of you recall this moment. If you don't recall it, you maybe saw the movie Apollo 13. And if you're not aware of this, there was this, you know, this moment in this historical thing that happened where there's a problem, there's an issue, there's something catastrophic that's happening, and a phrase emerged on April 14th, 1970. You know what it is? Houston, we have a problem. Yeah, you're right. Did you know you just misquoted it? He didn't actually say it like that, right? Yeah, you didn't know that. Yeah, anyway. Yeah. She's like, I knew that. Some of you are going to start Googling that. Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. I found out this week that it's actually a misquote. He didn't say those words specifically. The nuance is there, but typical to culture and society, we kind of just accept it as truth and we just move on. But he didn't actually say those intentional words. But we get the gist of it. We know that when someone says, Houston, we have a problem, there's an issue, there's a concern, there's, you know, something catastrophic that's happened. You've worked on a project at work for like months, and you get near the end and something happens with the server, and you go, Houston, we have a problem, and maybe a few other words in there with it, especially if it was that long of a project. Or you have a relational issue and you mutter to yourself, Houston, we have a problem. Or maybe you break down on the side of the road and you call a friend and you say, Houston, we have a problem. And his response immediately is, my name's not Houston, it's, you know, Jim or whatever. I don't know. That worked when I rehearsed it. But anyway, you know, we understand, right? We get this. We've kind of adopted this as sort of a way of life in this phrase, Houston, we have a problem. This week, as I was reflecting on our series, I began to realize that many of us probably have that same phrase when it comes to God or to faith, church, Jesus, whatever it might be. Some of us step back and we go, Houston, I have a problem. There's an issue. There's a concern. And for some, it can be catastrophic. We started the series last week, and we're diving in and looking at seven questions that skeptics may have about God and about the Christian faith. And we believe it's important for us to dive in and have these discussions because there's this interesting thing that's taking shape in our culture. I'm not sure if you're aware of it or not, but more and more people are checking off the box none when it comes to religious affiliation. There are people more inclined to walk away from the foundational truths of the Christian faith, of the Bible, and of God, and more like never before is this happening. Now, you might be sitting here and saying, well, Ron, that's not me. I'm totally in. I'm a lifer. I've been around church all my life. And, you know, I've bought in. I'm a follower of Jesus. But here's the thing. There's people in your life that have a problem with God, that have questions about God. And so maybe this series is going to be answering some of your personal questions, but it's also hopefully going to help you find some of the answers to the questions that some of your friends have. Have you ever felt lost when someone asks you a question about faith in God? And you're like, la, 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 you know, not to actually do that, but there's something inside of you that's doing that, your inside voice, and it's okay not to have those answers, but wouldn't it be great to be able to just dialogue a little bit more on it? Last week, we talked about the existence of God. And we thought we'd start off real easy, you know, let's talk about the existence of God. It's just a simple topic. So we talked about it from two lenses. We talked about it from two angles, I should say. There was this idea of the evidence that proves the existence of God from creation. We looked at it through the mind behind the morals. We talked about right and wrong. We talked about justice and fairness. And we also talked about the universe and how the universe came into existence is absolutely miraculous. And we talked about dials and, you know, values and everything. And if you missed it, you can actually watch it online if you want, or download the app and you can watch it there. But today, I want to talk about the Bible. I want to talk about one of the stumbling blocks that gets in the way of people understanding God. Because let's face it, when you look at the Bible, sometimes it can be super confusing. It can be really complicated. It can be difficult. It could be, Houston, I have a problem. I mean, this ancient text written ages ago, but yet we're drawn to it to try to figure it out. Yet we pull away from it. What do we do with it? How do we answer the questions about, what about the Bible? Now, I want to say right up front with you, and I part of who I am is to be as transparent as possible, appropriate levels of transparency with you, but because I just need to get out there, and I'm not saying this to just earn brownie points with you or to, you know, identify with some of you, but I have a problem with the Bible myself. I do. This book I have a problem with. I read stories about going into towns and villages and killing the women and children and animals. I have stories that, you know, are, you know, like this king is supposed to impale this king on a pole. I read stories about a flood that kills everybody. I read about a man who's supposed to sacrifice his son. I read about a dude who's disobeying God. He gets thrown in the water and swallowed up by big fish. I go, okay, what? Now, you need to know, I've spent a good chunk of my life reading this book. When I turned 17, I kind of had this encounter with Jesus. Not kind of, I did. And it changed my life, this encounter with Jesus. And then it began a really significant journey of trying to figure this book out, to lean into this book. And so I've read it cover to cover a number of times. I'm halfway through reading it again in a year. And I don't suggest you read it cover to cover if you're newer to faith, because it can be super confusing and it can be super hard to do. And so I'm halfway through again. I've spent 3 years in Bible college. I spent 25 years preaching it. I've spent more hours than I can express to you reading it, and I still have problems with it. Because there's times I look at it and I read it, and it's like it zeroes in on an area of my life that I don't want to go to. It's like, how do you love people that aren't lovable? It deals with it. How do you treat the marginalized? How do you love and express this thing called love more than just a feeling? How do you forgive others? How do you parent? And how do you treat your spouse? And I read it and I go, man, I got issues with this. Because it comes too close to home in a lot of cases. And so for some of us, you might be saying the same things. Yeah, those stories, man, they're just out there. Or I stay away from it because sometimes it speaks too close to the heart of what's going on in my life. Now, I say that I have a problem with it. Maybe you do too. But does that mean that we back away from it? No. Not a chance. Does that mean we put it on a shelf and just let it collect dust? No. No. Because I believe that we still need this as a necessary part of our journey of faith. We need this to speak into our lives. And so maybe what we need to do is we need to approach it just a little bit different than what we typically do. Maybe we need to approach it with in a way where we don't assume what it says, or we don't try to make it say things that it doesn't say. Have you ever been influenced by someone when it comes to a movie and they say, don't go see that movie. It's a terrible movie. The plot line's terrible. The character development is awful. And then a year later, it comes out on Netflix and you watch it and you're like, wow, that was a really good movie. Why did I listen to them? Because some of us have developed opinions and thoughts about it, doesn't mean that we shouldn't approach it and come near it. Doesn't mean that we should just put it on a shelf. We should actually still continue to try to explore it. It's a fascinating book, isn't it? Filled with unbelievable stories and moments. I want to talk about what is the Bible. I want to talk about this, and then I'm going to take you to a story to help us answer, ask better questions about the Bible, and then we'll just do some application. We're going to close with a great song this morning. So what is actually the Bible? Well, we've already kind of alluded to the fact that the Bible is actually a collection of letters and poems and writings by ancient people in ancient times, written by people in real circumstances, in real times. There's letters and poems and prophecies that are written in this. This ancient text, and the scribes that would write the scriptures would take great care in making sure that the content was accurate and true. Accurate and true. See, there for some of us is the stumbling block. There is for some of us the Houston, I have a problem moment. Is it historically true? Is it accurate? There's the book that we're taking this series from. It's called The Problem of God, and they're available out in the atrium after the service. But Mark Clark, in his book, Problem of God, he speaks to this truth about the accuracy and the trustworthiness of the scriptures. And he does it in a very interesting way, and he fills it in quite a bit. But I'm just going to give you a snippet of what he talks about. He talks about two things that emerge when we're looking at a document that is accurate and trustworthy. There's two things that come into play. The first one is the amount of manuscripts that we actually have when it comes to something that we trust as accurate and true. So, for example, let me bring up on the screen for you this guy. I only bring this up because I'm super proud I can say his name. Thucydides. Anyone know him? Oh, score one for the pastor. Thucydides, 460 to 365 BC, right? He wrote about he was a Roman historian. He was able to write accuracy and stuff about the Romans. And what's fascinating about this is that we trust what he writes is accurate and true. And there's eight documents still available. So go like this with me. This is leading somewhere, so you have to do this. Eight. Some of you are going like this. That's not eight. That's nine. Eight, okay? So what about this guy? Go to the next slide. Alexander the Great, okay? Right? So we have actually two documents that we trust that portrays who Alexander the Great is, and they're accurate and true, and so we kind of just accept them, okay? Now, I don't have a screen for you, but what about the New Testament? Did I have you do two? No, I did eight. No, do two. Do two. Two pieces of it. Yeah, because we're going somewhere with this. What about the New Testament? What about just the Gospels? Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. The stories that capture the life of Jesus. How many documents do you think are around for that? Get a load of this. 25,000 original documents. 25,000. Okay, so I want you to hold your hands up and do this. And I want you to do that 2,500 times. Ready? No? Some of us can't count past 10, so we're okay. Think about that. We have eight with Thucydides, and we go, he's true, accurate, we believe what he said. What about Alexander the Great? We've got two, eight and two. Now we've got 25,000. Okay, what's the other piece that is introduced to the trustworthiness and accuracy of the historical things that we believe? It's the distance of time in which the documents are written. Do you know that Thucydides is 1,300 years after the events that he writes about? 1,300 years. Alexander the Great is 400 years. New Testament, the Gospel, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Do you know how many years after Jesus lived that they wrote these letters? 30 to 50 years. That is awesome. Maybe you're not feeling it, but it's awesome. The reason is this, is because when you're writing letters like this, when Mark's penning, you know, the Gospel of Mark, and he's like going on about the life of Jesus and the things that Jesus did, you can actually go to people that are still alive and say, is this true? There's times when you see written in the Gospels, you see something written about so-and-so from this town. The reason why they're doing it is that they're saying, you can actually go ask him. He's still alive. We were feeding 5,000 people. I was there. There was leftovers. I saw it with my own eyes. The guy that carried the cross for Jesus, oh yeah, I heard about the resurrection. I saw that the tomb was empty. Oh, it's unbelievable. You can go see him. He lives in this town. I mean, so beautiful, isn't it? That we put such value on how many manuscripts it have and how close to the writings it is, but yet when we look at the scriptures, we shrug and we're skeptical about the historical truth of what it is, and we go, wow, 25,000 written 30 to 50 years in there, afterlife of Jesus. Now, some of you are going like, okay, Ron, I really don't care about that. Some of you are like just glazed over right now, right? And so let's actually approach it from a different angle. Let's actually look at this from a whole other angle. And it has to do with how we ask questions about the Bible. See, I think there's something about it that we sometimes miss about the Bible, because sometimes we ask the wrong questions. Have you ever read something in the Bible and you go, how could God do that? See, I think that's the wrong question to ask. We need to ask, why did the writer see it as it something important to keep in the scriptures? Why did they want to record the story for us? What is it revealing about them? What is it revealing about us? See, some of the things we need to keep in mind are when we read these stories that are so confusing that create skepticism in our hearts and our souls is because this is written by people in an ancient context, real people, real time, and at a time that you and I, we don't understand, we don't get. Very different times. Let me give you an example of this. I want to take you to a guy named Abraham. Abraham is this really great moment that I want to explore with you. Abraham's asked to do something crazy, okay? This is, comes down to asking better questions. Ready? Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 through 3 says, "The Lord had said to Abram, 'Leave your native country, your relatives, and your father's family, and go to the land that I will show you. I will make you into a great nation. I will bless you and make you famous, and you will be a blessing to others. I will bless those who bless you and curse those who treat you with contempt. All the families on the earth will be blessed through you.'" Now, what is God doing here in this moment, and what are we learning? The first thing we need to understand is that God is setting apart a group of people for himself. That God is setting apart a group of people through Abram. He's going to be eventually called Abraham. So if I use both names, just know it's the same guy. So Abram now is being spoken to by God, and he's going to become a great nation. And through this is going to be God's people. Now, ancient context, we've got to keep this in mind. Ancient context, it's tribal. It's tribal. It's not like us today. It's much more ancient tribal in the sense, in the day and age which this is written, it was like kill or be killed. The violence is unbelievable when you think about it. So when you read about a tribe going and taking over another tribe, they would have to kill everybody just in case someone rose up from that tribe to revenge you later. And so that's why these tribes would go and they would just slaughter everybody. You didn't want to leave anybody alive because it was kill or be killed, right? You would do a census and you would take a stock on, is our tribe bigger than their tribe? Can we actually take him? You know, are we, is my dad bigger than your dad? You know, can we actually do this? Also, on top of that, we must understand that the tribal context, when you read this, is that they would give credit to their god or goddess for their actions. So they would believe that their god or goddess told them to go and do those. It's how they talked. It was just normal. The other part of what they would do in the tribals is they would offer sacrifices to their gods because they wanted to earn favor in their god's eye, and so therefore they wanted victory, they wanted crops, and they wanted blessing, and so they would offer sacrifices. Okay? Got the context? God speaks to Abraham, "Hey, Abraham, hey, got a plan for us. There's a new tribe on the block, and we're going to do something different." Now, this all unfolds, and this unbelievable moment happens. God actually provides a son and a descendant, and we see this crazy thing happen. Abraham's wife is Sarah, and they're about 100 years old, and she gets pregnant. Lots to say about that. I'm pretty proud of him, to be honest, but anyway. I'd walk around camp swagger on, you know? Like, anyway, too much information. I don't know how Sarah's feeling at 100 having a baby. I just never know, but I'd be like, yeah. So they have a son. His name's Isaac. A little time later, Genesis 22. Sometime later, God tests Abraham's faith. "Abraham, God called you." "Abraham, God called." "Yes," he replied, "here am I. Take your son, your only son. Yes, Isaac, whom you love so much. And go to the land of Moriah, go and sacrifice him as a burnt offering on one of the mountains which I will show you." Houston, I got a problem. How could God do this? How could God do this? Is that the right question to ask? You know, if it was me, I've got two sons, and I was asked to sacrifice them, I'd have some serious questions. I'd really struggle. You know why? Because we don't live in that time. Do you know what was very common for people to do in their tribes? Was to sacrifice their children. tribes would do it to earn the favor of their gods. It was very normal. We don't get that. It says in verse 4 that the next morning, Abraham got up and he went to the place that God showed him. I'm like, Abraham, you should have had a few more questions, right? The story unfolds. Abraham goes for a three-day trip, and he ends up taking the altar and getting it all prepared, and he ties his son. There's some conversation in there. You can read it for yourself later today. But then he takes his son, he places it on the altar, and God steps in. He says, no, 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 Abraham. I'm going to provide for you. Here's a ram over here caught in the thicket. What is this telling us? See, anytime you read the scriptures, you must understand that it's people learning how to be human, learning how to interact with God, learning to understand who God is. In this moment, what is God doing? There's multiple layers to it, but one of the things that God is doing is he's saying to Abraham, Abraham, I'm not like all those other gods. I don't require human sacrifice. I'm actually a God that provides. Our tribe is going to be different. Our tribe is going to be different because I'm not like them. Can you imagine what it was like for Abraham to walk into camp with Isaac again? People would have known. It was very common. They understood this. But yet Abraham walks back into camp with Isaac. And can you imagine what that discussion was like? Can you imagine the stunned faces? Can you imagine the moment where Abraham says, everybody, gather around. You're not going to believe this. He doesn't require human sacrifice. We don't have to sacrifice our kids because this God is different than every other God. And it spread like crazy. Now you might say, okay, Ron, but hang on. Couldn't God just tell him, listen, I'm different. Action speaks louder than words, right? This was a life-changing moment for the tribe that God was bringing forth, that his tribe was going to be different. They were actually going to be used to bless others. You see how different it can be to ask the right questions? It's not the question of how could God do this. It's the question of why did they want to tell this story? Why did they want to make sure that people knew it and remembered it? What is it teaching to us? Because when you read stories like this, you can't just look at the surface. You must take time and allow God to kind of bring truth to you that brings it, understand there's stuff below it that is far deeper and greater and awe-inspiring that it just pulls us in. This is the power of the scriptures. This is the awe moments. See, sometimes we read these stories and we just pull away and we go, this can't be so. I just really can't get my head around it, so therefore I'm not going to read it because I'm not going to follow a God like that. My problem now is, how could he ask that? But the truth is, he's revealing something about himself. What did I say earlier? That these scriptures, that the Bible is written so that we understand what it means to be human. It's a progression. Maybe that's what we could talk about. It's the progression of humankind. We read the stories and it's their progression of understanding how to treat one another the way God intends us to treat one another, not killing and destroying and sacrificing. It is this beautiful thing that God is taking the journey on to bless others, and it's in process. They're learning how to relate to God at the same time. I mean, this is the most incredible, powerful thing when you step back and you look at it from a different angle. I love... As much as I have a problem with this book at times, I also love that it's a book that you can actually step back and you can move it around and begin to discover depths of things that you never thought before. It's like looking at a gem or a diamond and you spin it and you look at it. And just because the story says one thing doesn't necessarily mean it's always that one thing, because when you come back to it again and again and again, there's times where it means something different for you and it takes you to a different space because you're in a different time in your life, you're in a different stage of life, a season of life, and it has the ability to do that for us. See, it's not just the fact that we've got all these manuscripts and that we, you know, even when you think about the Gospels and the time frame in which it was written and other things that emerge from the scriptures, it's also the beauty and the wonder of what it does for us because it speaks into us. See, I think we sometimes get confused by the scriptures. They're written by people. A number of people over a period of 1,000 years. Their experiences, their worldview, their understanding, and we have to step into that somehow and allow it to speak to us now. Now, some of us are like, okay, Ron, this is fine, this is good, but there's some other verses that emerge in the scriptures that kind of bring some confusion to you, and you're going, and some of you have been around the Bible long enough and know exactly what verses might be, but it's 2 Timothy 3:16. Some of you are already thinking about this verse. You're like, okay, hang on, Ron, you said it's written by people. But what about this verse? It says, all scripture is inspired by God and is useful to teach us what is true and to make us realize what is wrong in our lives. It corrects us when we are wrong and teaches us to do what is right. I'm going to add an extra verse for us, I think. It says, God uses it to prepare and equip his people to do every good work. It's inspired. So this is where some of us get caught off guard and we kind of get pulled in and confused by it. The word inspired is this word God-breathed. It's two words put together to mean God breathed. And it's true that the writers were directed by God, but we can't remove the fact that their personality, their experiences, and their understanding of what was going on in that time also comes into play. The God breathed is a piece that emerges early in the scriptures when you see God created the first man out of the dust of the dirt and he breathed life into him. That's the same idea that the dirt guy came to life because the breath of God came into him. We understand that we are alive because of the breath that we breathe, right? It's the air that gives us life. When you look at this idea of what the scriptures are, what the Bible is, it is God's word. God breathed to us. So when we read it, it has the ability to give life to our faith. It's like air to our lungs. It's a necessary part of our lives if you're going to journey in faith. Because God, through this book, tells a beautiful story. It's a story of his people set apart to do great things. It's our story as it reflects who we are. And the beauty and the wonder of it is that it doesn't try to hide the ugliness of life, that there are people in it that struggled with who God was, questioned who God was, that they were screw-ups and mess-ups, and they doubted and they were confused, but yet God still told his story through them. And for me, that's inspiring because it speaks to who I am and it speaks to my journey. So often we push the book away and go, I don't need it, it's not necessary. But the truth is, we do need it. And whether you're a skeptic of it or not, the truth is, it's not going anywhere. It's not. It's been around a super long time, and it's not going anywhere. So my question for you this morning is will you allow it to begin to emerge in your life in a way that can bring life to your faith? Will you be okay with not knowing what it means at times? Will you be okay with going, Houston, I have a problem? When you pick the Bible up, don't try to pin it down. Don't try to tell it what it's supposed to say. Just let it be what it is. It's God's word for us. All morning I've been wrestling with why I feel so passionate about this. I really have been. I wish I could just motivate all of us to dig into this book and be okay with it, and I've committed my life to communicating it as best as I can, but I know that Sunday mornings is not enough. So my challenge to you today is this. It's maybe just as simple. Will you just start reading it and let it speak to you? Will you just open up and say, God, I just need you to show me who you are in it? Because it's a story of humanity and their desire to understand God. Listen to this song. Let's stand. week two of the Bible. You know, I don't know what your understanding or perspective is on it, but we hope that this morning we've given you some new perspective on it, new thoughts about it. Don't be afraid of it. Ask the questions that you need to ask and allow God by His Spirit to teach you. Don't view it as a textbook. Don't view it as an owner's manual. Don't view it as an IKEA instruction manual. You know those ones? View it as God's word to us. It's alive and it's powerful and has the ability to speak directly into our heart and soul. May you be people of His word. I want to invite you back next week. We're going to deal with a topic that I know for many of us we struggle with. What's up with the suffering? What's up with evil? And we're going to give some perspective on that. May God bless you as you leave this place. And remember to be people of His word. We'll see you next week.